Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with My Opel, rewarding loyalty and taking care of members.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
There's a major story breaking from New York. Neil O'Dowd is editor of the Irish Vice. Neil, good afternoon to you.
Joe, how are you?
What's happening? It's the World Trade Center.
World Trade Center. We've had two planes crashed into the World Trade Center. One as little as 18 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, some very, very sketchy details reaching us here at Sky Centre. Important enough to bring to you, though, at this early stage. We believe that a plane has crashed.
This just
into
in,
the
you
World
were looking
Trade
at a, obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports.
47 a.m.
Well, we can all remember, can't we, where we were when we heard those shocking reports two decades ago. It was a day that changed not only America, but the world. But for some, September 11th, 2001 is etched into their memories forever. And one of those people is Oklahoma man Andrew Rice, whose older brother David was killed in the World Trade Center. I spoke to Andrew yesterday and I began by asking him to take me back to September 11th, 2001 and describe his life at that time. He was a young journalist working at the Sundance Film Festival in Toronto.
Yeah, I was living in New York as a young man and I freelanced. But by that point, I was doing quite a bit of work actually for the BBC. There was a show in New York called Talking Movies with movie reviews. And I did some editing and producing and was doing a little bit of journalism as well. So it was the first time, well, actually the second time I'd been to the Sundance Film Festival with work. And then we were up in Toronto covering the film festival.
And your brother David was 31 at the time and he was working in the World Trade Center as an investment banker.
Yeah, so he, I woke up that morning, was walking to help start up with an interview. I was going to partner with a Spanish crew. And I got a phone call from my mother in Oklahoma, where we all grew up, saying that there had been an accident of some sort or some sort of incident. And then when I got to the festival headquarters at the hotel, the televisions were showing the images. And sort of, you know, that was very shocking and an upsetting thing to see. And then when I saw the towers begin to, you know, implode and fall, I actually was going to see my boss and I sort of fell down in his apartment. When I saw that, I just sort of had this overwhelming, it was very overwhelming to see. And not knowing really what had happened to my brother yet, but he was able to secure me a car and a driver like you'd take to the airport. It was the only way I could get back from Toronto to New York. So he hired me a car and a driver and drove me 9 hours from Toronto back down to New York City. And we were able to talk our way through the border and have our car inspected and explain what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Before we return to 9/11 and the events that followed on from there for you, I was reading your own account of your relationship with your brother. You were close and both wild as teenagers, you say.
Yeah, we, you know, in sports and in life, you know, we both had gotten involved in drinking and drug use as teenagers. And I followed him into recovery in my early 20s. My mother actually had struggled with those issues and had gotten into recovery. And then my brother had a pretty bad bottom in his 20s. And so it was something we shared together, but then also recovery. In fact, the last time I was with him before leaving for Toronto and before he was killed on 9/11 was at a recovery meeting in New York. So it was a unique time in our life because he and my sister and I, all as young adults, were living in New York, even though we had grown up together in a family in Oklahoma City.
So to come back then to 9/11, you got to New York. Your sister was there, as you say. She was already living there. Can you take us back to that time when you arrived back in the city?
Yeah, so we pulled into the northern part of the island, and you could see, you know, huge plumes of smoke, and the city lights of Manhattan were reflected up through the smoke, perhaps also the fire down at the site. So it was very, very surreal, and we met up with some friends that were going to sort of support us and take care of us in the upper part of Manhattan. And about a day or two later, as we were awaiting word, you know, at that time, a lot of family members were scouring lists on the internet of survivors and going and putting flyers and little posters at hospitals and such. And my parents back in Oklahoma City got a call from the the New York City Police Department that they believe that David's body had been recovered at the site, which is a very unique thing actually to happen at all with the 9/11 attacks, but particularly that early. Mm-hmm. It also, it's also an interesting reminder that on the death certificate that they mailed to my family, it was homicide was the cause of death. And because it became a very obviously sort of inevitably, an issue around terrorism and war, and you knew that there was probably going to be war starting sometime soon. So we got into a couple vans with our friends and drove all the way back to Oklahoma, and David had, they had a funeral. We had a funeral for David a week later.
So it's very quick, isn't it? I mean, it all happened so fast.
Yeah, yeah. They were able to fly his body back, even though commercial airlines were grounded. And I believe his body landed in Oklahoma, a couple hours before the funeral.
So after that time, and you mentioned it there, America was in absolute turmoil. And people, in thinking about these events 20 years on, will be transported back to that time where the vice president was saying, if you're against us, you'll feel our wrath. Now, you become wrapped up in all of that by virtue of the fact that you've lost your brother.
Yeah, there's multiple things going on, when you're in a family member's shoes. You're going through the national collective shock of the way of life in America changing forever, the sense of security that most Americans, maybe more secure, affluent Americans, had it more than others who had had, difficult lives here. And then you had the personal loss. And then you had sort of this fork in the road of, are you going to go along with just this idea that vengeance and sort of very black and white either or sort of thinking was going to take place, or were you going to sort of try to push for a more, I don't know, nuanced or selective of saying, we need to sort of proceed carefully. Obviously, we need to hold those responsible accountable. But how do we try to avoid making worse problems for ourselves and for people who, weren't the guilty parties? And I had a real concern about that early on, and take no pride really now two decades later as a middle-aged man, take no pride that a lot of what I was worried about happened. I got involved in speaking out pretty early on about, particularly around the issues of civil liberties with the Patriot Act. And then of course, how we were going to go about Afghanistan. But then when we went into Iraq, it's when that ratcheted up quite a bit, because there was no relation to what had happened on 9/11.
Did you feel vengeful though, certainly in the initial stages?
Yeah, no, I was very angry. So I had, there was this sense of, wanting accountability. I think the vengeance never was quite that strong, partially because of the recovery work. I sort of knew when you're carrying that around inside in your chest could mean a lot of trouble for myself, mm-hmm. and something that was really going to sort of weigh my life down. So my parents actually, from the beginning, though devastated, they were in a very sort of peace-minded, reconciliatory sort of framework of how they were talking about it. Again, they weren't active. Like I got active in the peace movement. They weren't that, but there was definitely, that made an impact on my sister and I and some of our friends, that it was like, we had a good life with David and we don't want more to come out of this, bad to come out of this, and for it to be sort of a perpetual state of, back and forth of vengeance. So
was it around that time that you discovered Peaceful Tomorrows online?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I can't remember how I found them. I was, sort of surprised to see, and actually some members of Peaceful Tomorrows before I joined traveled to Afghanistan when the war was sort of stabilizing. Was moved by that and just sort of the message and wrestling with those issues. As I got older, I knew that there were sort of no easy answers to this, right? I mean, I started off with concerns about the Afghanistan war in the sense of nation building, right? And now, two decades later, it's not funny, I chuckle, but now I probably in the position more of what would have been the conservative position then, but is not in America, which is, we probably should consider having some sort of force presence there in some small way to keep secure and to keep stability and to avoid what's happened here, although most conservatives now in the U.S. have, wanted out.
And do you believe now that that presence should be there more for humanitarian reasons or in a peacekeeping
yes.
role?
Yeah, as a deterrent. I mean, it was clear, I'm no expert on Afghanistan, but it was clear that there was some sort of deterrent effect going on in recent years, right, with American troops being present, with our ability to, you know, with these drones and planes and things. So just seems that it fell apart pretty quickly. And there are a lot of other issues, sort of installing leaders that we thought would be good for Afghanistan rather than letting, and, you know, and that's part of maybe what's going on in Afghanistan, that organically and in a sort of a populist spirit, that the Taliban is what a lot of the people in the rural areas maybe want. But I don't know. It's hard to see. It's hard to see the withdrawal now and it all falling apart in a way seeming like it's going back to where it started 20 years ago.
Yes. Well, your perspective on the entire thing is so unique and interesting to hear. You got the opportunity to meet the mother of the alleged 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. How did that meeting come about, Andrew?
And she lives in France, or did at the time, and there were human rights group that was bringing her back and forth to the U.S. so she could visit her son. And then he was being held in a federal prison. And they reached out to some people who were involved in peace work in the U.S. and reconciliatory work, and they got in touch with Peaceful Tomorrows. And my sister and I and a couple other people from the group decided that we would meet with her. She requested to meet with family members of 9/11. I remember vividly the email said that she wanted our forgiveness. And one of the things that I and pretty much everybody there expressed to her when we met with her in private was that we didn't feel she was responsible, you know, for her son's involvement or actions. And it was a very moving couple hours. And I really was also motivated to want to understand, you know, on a very human, basic level, about her son's life. What was it that got him caught up in this? You know, that was probably a deeper yearning at that time. I was speaking out in sort of political terms, but I had this more emotional need to sort of understand why it had happened and the history that led up to 9/11 and to sort of make sense of it.
And how did she receive that compassion?
I think she was very grateful. We were grateful for the opportunity to learn, you know, her life experience. She was a single mother, had been in an abusive relationship. Zacharias, from what I recall, there was definitely concerns of mental illness, which my guess is somewhat common with these extremist groups. One of the Phyllis Rodriguez, a woman who had lost her son, her and her husband had lost her son in the World Trade Center. She continued on a very close friendship with Aisha for many years. And there's a documentary film in the United States about that relationship.
And your plans then to mark the 20-year anniversary, you are traveling to New York.
Yeah, my sister still lives there, and she has a boy who's my nephew's getting ready to turn two. So I'll be traveling to New York, and we'll go down to the site, which I haven't been down there for. Well, I haven't been to a ceremony for 10 years. I've been to the site a couple times in the last decade. So we'll go down and pay our respects and spend time together, and also enjoy the aspects of New York, the good memories of when I lived there and she's lived there, and my brother, and spend time with my nephew.
Mm-hmm. I'm just reading again the David's obituary from the New York Times, which was published on the 17th of September in 2001. I know you found it difficult to read this at the time, but then you revisited it. I think it's a beautiful piece. It's short. I'll just read a bit of it so people can get a sense of the man. He was a student, yes, with the grade point average of less than 2, who was voted most likely to succeed in high school. He was constantly in trouble. He would do things like rent a warehouse in Oklahoma City, hire a rock band, charge $10 a head, and make $1,000 before the police broke up the party. Now, then we know he went on to become very successful, but he sounds like quite the character.
He was quite the character, maybe a little larger than people would assume, a little larger than life, but he was something. Yeah, he was and a big heart, you know, so he made an impact on his short number of years alive on a lot of people. And, you know, that happens when you lose someone, too. We went to do a memorial service in Chicago where he had lived right before 9/11, and had people come up and tell us ways that he had touched them or done things for them that, you know, he had never told us. some of that adage that, you know, to do a good deed and it doesn't count unless no one knows about it. So you start finding out ways in which he had been there for people that were really touching that I maybe never would have known about if this had never happened.
Andrew, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time to chat to us today. And we wish you well marking this special anniversary. I'm sure it's going to be difficult, but I hope that you find further peace this weekend. Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
And now we're a little late going to the newsroom, but it's over to Susan Jackson.